Welcome everyone to Rockin' Nation Podcast. My name is Sam Snelling. This is a brand new, brand spankin' new episode of Dive Cuts. This is the podcast where we talk about Mizzou basketball. With me as always, good friend Matt Harris. He is playing the role of the, I guess, you've already had COVID. So you're the immune in this case, but not the case with Missouri basketball. Matt, how are you?
I'm fine. My case was thanks to a hairdresser giving my wife COVID as on our wedding day as they got hair and makeup done, which was then shared with me. So, hopefully how the Missouri players, or Missouri staff or whoever tier one personnel were infected was not as boring as my story, but I got over it. I didn't experience really any symptoms off of it. I was practically asymptomatic, so I guess I should count myself lucky.
I mean, other than the fact that it occurred over your honeymoon, which
I mean, it was going to be a lounge. It was going to be a loungy honeymoon anyway. So that just locked it in.
Yeah.
It just settled that game plan. And the nice thing about it is in this environment is, like, if you're in Savannah, Georgia, you can call a fine restaurant and do a pickup order and, like, have them bring it to the car, and you're good. So I ate just as well as I would have if I had sat or dined in a restaurant that week. So it was, aside from, you know, quarantining around a Airbnb, it was pretty much like it would have been anywhere else. But other than that, I'm fine now. I'm healthy now. I've had no ill effects, and I hope that it's the same for all the guys in the program right now and all the staff. It's definitely not. No, we're kind of making light of it, but it's definitely not something that you want to experience.
We've talked enough throughout this the pandemic expressing the seriousness of it. And so I guess for folks that are tuning in, it is Monday, January 11th. That's when we're recording. The Mizzou basketball program is officially on a pause after an unknown number of positive tests. Sources inside the program have indicated that everybody is feeling all right. It has not taken anybody, experiencing anything other than maybe some mild effects. There was no indication that anyone was, really, that there was a big concern that this is going to have a serious drag in the season. That's what I got out of it. It does sound like they are hopeful that they are going to be able to play this weekend, and hopefully be able to get back on track. Because the fun thing about trying to play sports in a pandemic, particularly the way the SEC scheduled things, is they didn't really leave you a lot of wiggle room. So while there is a padding of a week that they could make some games up at the end of the season, there's not a lot of room to make up games beyond that, unless you start packing games, multiple games in the middle of the week, and
then you're getting into a question of, are guys playing too much, and if you're playing that much, are you, putting guys in positions where stress injuries become a play? So there are knock-on effects of that. I know some people say they're 18 to 22 years old, but it's, especially if you're getting late in the season, when you've had dings and you've been banged up or nicked up as the season's gone along, you start to feel that in mid to late February. And then if you're trying to pack in, you get in a situation where you're trying to play three games a week, and you've got to come out of that into a SEC tournament where you may be playing three to four games over consecutive days. It's a heavy workload. So they get an 11-day break now, but I would almost imagine that one, just for the routine and for the sake of normalcy, they would rather have two games and a normal schedule. But also, it's an even distribution of work rate over the season. So that's probably the first thing you think of when you hope that it's limited, is one, that people are healthy and able to, come back and, you know, practice and play at something resembling full strength. But also, I don't think anybody wants to be in a situation where we're getting into late February and you're playing 8-9 games in the span of, you know, 2.5 weeks. That's just a lot to put on guys at that time of year. So here's to hoping that Saturday's, you know, a game that they can get in and they can get back into some semblance of a rhythm from here on out. And this is the worst disruption they're going to have.
Yeah, so not only Missouri, South Carolina is on their second pause.
Yeah.
And I think I counted that Ole Miss paused beginning of the season. Tennessee paused the beginning of the season. Vanderbilt was on pause.
Florida was on pause, I think.
Well, so I think Florida was more like...
No, they were having... They had... What, I think they may have had something in the summer.
Did they have something maybe at the beginning of the year that they pushed off some games and then kind of came back?
Yeah.
Because I know that they paused after Keontae Johnson... had his episode.
But they've had some hiccups down there.
So that's half the league.
Yeah. Which, and then you see tonight that Nebraska's going to go on pause. Iowa State and Kansas State are postponed. Villanova and Gonzaga have each had to briefly hit pause this season. So it's much more prevalent, I think, if you look at the stoppages. I think Jeff Goodman had something out today where he shared that there are 44 programs on pause and like 80% of them are in mid and low major leagues, which isn't a surprise given how leaner budgets are down there. And that kind of restricts the frequency of testing you can do. So it's hard. It's a little more difficult to manage at the mid and low major level, but still we've seen stoppages at the high major level. Missouri's turn came this week. And like I said, if they get through with everybody in, you know, not experiencing, you know, the worst of the symptoms that you could, that's in the epidemiology of this thing or in the pathology of this thing, you can only miss two games. That's coming away relatively with a relatively light bill for this program.
Yeah, and also considering all the issues that the NBA seems to be going through, did you read it? We're getting a little bit of sidetracked, but did you read it all? Like, apparently the NBA's like COVID guidance, like they're saying that you can't really catch COVID like playing in a basketball game, which is like utterly ridiculous.
That would seem to defy how droplet spread works, but that's again, I just work for a medical school. I am not a medical professional, but everything that I've talked to with our guys here who manage infectious disease about this is that airborne droplets aren't like selective on when they like go out or don't. They just kind of get propelled. They don't really have like any self-determinism. They're not like, I'm going to hang out in Seth Curry's mouth for 2 hours while we play this game. It's, yeah. Philadelphia 76 having to play with 7 guys. Cleveland getting a waiver to sign Yogi Ferrell on a 10-day deal to go over the roster slot max. It's the NBA is not covering itself in glory after demonstrating that you could play sports in a bubble. They chucked that plan. And I get it. They want to hopefully have some limited arena capacity at some point. They want to have players don't want to go and be away from their family again. But part of me thinks if they were going to start it up, maybe they should have started the first 2 months in a bubble, waited till vaccinations got to a certain level, and then considered moving back. Because you're right, it's been a complete shit show.
Well, I do think that like there's even some more like regionalized bubbles that you could have done. You know, to maybe make things just a little bit better. And I like, it's kind of like what the NCAA is doing with March Madness. They're moving everything to Indianapolis or the Indianapolis area, which I think is a smart thing. You know, because the one thing that you really don't want to do is you just don't want to have people flying all over the country. You know, I feel when you get everybody in one spot, you can control things a little bit better. I think that we've seen the Mohegan Sun had some success kind of doing it that way. And again, like there's no perfect system. I mean, even, you know, we saw that even the NBA bubble, as successful as it was fairly leaky, and that was also at a time when, like, COVID
community infection.
Yeah, like COVID overall was way more under control than it is right now. So
when they do it in Indy, what they're going to have working for them is all their locations, aside from Mackey and Assembly Hall, are all within like 15 minutes of downtown. The number of hotel rooms downtown here is insane. So you're going to be able to quarantine and spread guys. The practice floors that they decide to do at the convention center here, I mean, it's a massive convention center. It's one of, I think, the three or four largest in the country. So they're going to be able to spread teams in practice gyms. The other thing that's sort of underrated here, but is kind of an important deal in a pandemic, is downtown Indianapolis has like five hospitals, like literally 3 minutes away from Lucas Oil and Bankers Life Fieldhouse. When they had the NFL Combine testing here, one of the reasons why they kept it in Indy is all the hotel rooms in proximity to Methodist Hospital here are minutes away, and that's where they do all like the physical testing, like, and medical testing for NFL Combine prospects. So you've got a lot of hospitals, you've got a lot of hotel rooms, and you've got relatively close proximity for all your bubbles. The farthest one away here is probably, like, in actual Indy, is going to be Hinkle. That's probably going to be about, driving-wise, about 15 to 20 minutes from downtown.
And they're doing Bloomington, too, right?
Yeah. The interesting thing there is that I think what they would be smart to do is just to put teams in bubbles in Bloomington and in West Lafayette. Like, you look at a map and you think, oh, West Lafayette's not that far away, and then you try and drive to West Lafayette, and it's not like a straight shot on 65. You've got to, like, meander a bit. Same with Bloomington. Bloomington's about 45 minutes south, and they're doing a lot of construction down there. If they were smart, they would just, like, they would just bubble it, and you just have eight teams down in Bloomington, eight teams staying up in West Lafayette, and then once you, like, cull the teams down enough, you bring everybody back to Indianapolis. But logistically, like, it's worthwhile to do it here. Marion County is not sure if they're even gonna, like, it's way too early to even talk about having fans here, but they picked it, my guess is because of centrality, number of venues. You have a bunch of, like I said, hospitals around, and, like, the NCAA headquarters is three blocks from Lucas Oil, so there's a lot of administrative and infrastructure reasons why it's coming here. But it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, and how they make it work. But they definitely have, you know, all the facilities, all the kind of personnel that they're going to need to try and make it happen. The big deal will be what happens when they try and get teams in and pre-testing and making sure coming into that sort of quarantine environment that everybody's good. And that everyone's clean when they arrive and has a clean bill of health. But we are not in that state right now. We are far away from that when it comes to Missouri basketball.
Well, technically, you are in that state.
I am. I reside here. It's a lovely... I love Indianapolis. I would encourage everyone to visit here. Underrated food scene. Normally, we have a pretty good concert scene here. You can get in and out of the airport here really easily. It's a wonderful community. I love living in Indy. But it'll be interesting what happens when March gets here and how they try and pull this off. But Indy's got experience hosting this kind of stuff. So I have faith that they'll at least try and have a good plan in place. Whether it works, who knows?
Yeah, I think that's where a lot of things are at this point. So Missouri's on pause. That happened prior to the game on Saturday, which was expected to be LSU. LSU pivoted and was able to
kick the crap out of Ole Miss.
Yeah, and I kind of commented to you, it's just like, you know, sometimes when it comes to LSU, like, you either get fully engaged LSU or you get lackadaisical LSU, and I feel like Missouri over the last few years has gotten lackadaisical LSU. You know, and part of that is, yeah, obviously, you know, Konzo's teams have typically kind of come into a lot of games really looking prepared, you know, maybe with a handful outstanding, but they've looked prepared against LSU, and LSU looked very prepared for Ole Miss. And so with Missouri not playing, I decided it was probably a decent idea to kind of put together a little bit of like a power rankings, like we'll call them power rankings, but, you know, just kind of looking back at where we thought the SEC would be kind of going into the season and where they are. And I was actually kind of surprised, like, when I started looking at everything at how close to the expectations we were. I think the only team, and I'm still, I said this in my writing, it still not completely sold that Mississippi State is, you know, like a top six team or anything like that, but they're, you know, they've certainly won the games that are on their schedule, aside from a double overtime loss to Kentucky. Kentucky has looked like they may have figured something out in Gainesville. You know, even though they've looked, you know, pretty atrocious for the rest of the schedule. So with all that kind of going forward, I mean, Missouri kind of coming off their second loss of the year and, you know, both losses in the SEC, you know, I dropped them to seventh, despite the fact that I think their record overall and their resume is top 25 worthy. At this point in SEC play with them being 1-2, I had them at seventh.
I think it's a fair way to slot them. I think going into the LSU game last week, I sent you just like a snapshot or a screenshot of kind of where Missouri's offensive ratings have been in each of their games this season or their efficiency on the offensive end of the floor. And it's been in a steady decline since over the last four or five games. You know, they had a good outing at Arkansas, but part of me wonders how much of that had to do with Justin Smith's absence and how that kind of forced Arkansas to adjust its rotation a little bit. But, you know, they struggled offensively. They've probably put together three good halves, three bad halves. Then there's the Bradley game on top of that. The jump shooting at this point, as we've talked about numerous times, is probably not in a valley. This is probably just its steady state. Drew Smith has looked out of sorts. How much of that is from the wrap on his hand, I'm not sure. But, you know, there's been the recent foul troubles there. There's been the ball handling issues there. And so their non-conference record still is what it is. They still have four quad one wins on their schedule. They're still ranked 17th. But I think you look at their trajectory they've been on, it's been a little, you know, I think things have gotten a little bit dicier for them. I think teams have figured out the scout on this group. And as you move forward, the real question going to the LSU game was, that felt like you didn't want to put too much weight on it, but it felt like a tipping point in some senses, because if they had lost that game, they'd be at 1-3 right now. A win would have had them level. So I look at the recent performances of the last four or five games and just kind of what the trend lines have been, and I don't think putting them at seventh is at all a slight. I think, you know, you could acknowledge they had a really, really good non-con record, but, you know, the recent data points have not been as lustrous for them. I think the real question moving forward is this their ceiling, you know, or is this kind of where we expected them to settle out? You know, I think a couple weeks ago you had said that they were looking like a team that could maybe push for, you know, finishing fourth or fifth in the standings. And if that's still the ceiling, is this kind of a steady state for them? Do they settle out at seventh, or do we have to revise looking at where the floor and the ceiling is for this group? I still think it's too early, but there are some signs that maybe they're leveling off a little bit, and we'll see where they wind up. But I think having them, you know, right there with Florida and Arkansas is probably a fair place to slot them.
Yeah, so I think this is sort of, I don't know, where you and I, we kind of tend to be a little bit more reserved, both through good times and bad times. And, you know, as I always like to say, I think I tend to be a little bit more optimistic about certain things. And so I say that because even kind of coming into the season, I feel like I was kind of talking you into Missouri a little bit more than maybe they deserved to be talked up. And mainly because, like, I still believe in the baseline talent of the team, and I still thought that, you know, like, the preseason projections overall were pretty low. And really all Missouri needed was just a little bit of a break for them to... And I never really thought that we'd be talking about a top 25 team. You know, but you go out and you beat Oregon, you beat Illinois, you remain undefeated until conference play starts, even in an abbreviated non-conference season, then you're gonna open some eyes nationally. That being said, I still feel like Missouri's a little overranked by a lot of people. You know, and so, like, I think Jeff Goodman still has them at like 16 or 17, and it's just like, I mean,
the AP has them at 17 today. So I mean, they're...
I mean, it's just like, I do think that, like, Missouri's ceiling, which I don't really feel like they've played there yet, but I still kind of feel like this team's ceiling is still kind of outside the top 25. And I really think, like, when the season is over with and you're looking at everyone's complete resume, I mean, the top 25 to me is always going to be a little bit of a weird thing because, you know, the Big Ten is going to do a great job of beating up on each other. But there's really, like, probably 8 or 9 teams that are deserving of being ranked in the top 25, but some of those teams are going to have records that are pretty ugly. You know, if you're just kind of looking at... So, all right, I'm gonna pull up the Big Ten real quick, so we can... Cause...
I mean, the Big Ten's average adjusted efficiency rate right now is 18.82. The Big 12 is 18.14. And there's just a 3-point gap with the ACC at 14.9. And then nearly a point gap with the SEC at 14.3. It's like the median Big Ten team, like among teams that are expected to go 500 in con, of a team that a 500 team in the Big Ten facing a 500 team in the SEC would be almost a 5-point favorite on a neutral floor. That's how wide the gap is right now between those two conferences. So it really is. That's not a small gap in efficiency margin at all. That's if I were to pull that up right now and just look at the KenPom rating at this point, the number right now, Houston is at number 11. They have a 23.9 adjusted efficiency rating. If you were to go down to 18, that would basically be about 20 spots in KenPom's rating right now. So that's really what you're looking at right now. The average Big Ten team is would probably be about 5 points on a neutral floor, 20 spots better than the average SEC team.
So I think, you know, like, one thing, you look at somebody like Maryland. Maryland's projected right now to go 9-11 overall. If Maryland finishes 9-11, they're currently 45th in KenPom. Let's say that they finish there. They're 9-11 in conference, 14-12 overall. They've lost to Clemson, who is top 20. Rutgers. Rutgers has slipped a bit, but they're top 40. Purdue's top 40. Michigan's top 10. Indiana's top 25. Iowa's top 5. They have wins over Illinois, who's top 10. They have they've beaten Wisconsin, who's 5th. And a bunch of, you know, mid-major type teams.
If you put them in the SEC right now, they would probably be projected to land somewhere probably around like 10 and 8 if you were to put them in the SEC.
Yeah.
In that range. So it's 3 or 4 wins in the win column.
They would actually right be between Florida, Missouri, and KenPom.
Yep. Maybe around 10 and 8 in the SEC.
Or sorry, I should clarify that because Kentucky has soared all the way up to 43rd after their big win at Florida.
Yeah. I think to your point about the ceiling, and this is a good time, I feel like, with the COVID pause to kind of like, and I'm going to hopefully have a post ready tomorrow kind of looking at where the rotation is and kind of my thoughts on that. I think it's a good time to kind of take an initial stock of this group in a certain way because you're about ready to hit the quarter pole. You've seen about 10 games, 9 or 10 games. And if in the past, KenPom has said, you know, in his rank, you know, in his view, like a team is what it is, at least from an analytics perspective, after 9 or 10 games. You don't see a lot of like major swings after that. Like a team's profile is kind of locked in at that point. And now you're going to start seeing some old data filter out. And so I think it's just this week would have been big because I think you would have started to say, okay, this team is what it is. They would have come out of LSU with that result, you know, being what it would have been, you know, win or loss at 2-2 or 1-3. And we would have turned the page to a week where the schedule would have lightened a little bit with Vandy and A&M. But I think we would have started to say, okay, this team looks like kind of what we think the finished product's going to be, and what is that? And to your point about where they are in the rankings right now and where they're rated, I think the voters have done what I would do if I were in their shoes. Or I would, you know, reward teams for what the results on the floor are. Like, you wrote this when you kind of did your thing, did your piece on understanding efficiency margin. Just the circumstances around how analytic models are spitting out results right now is unusual. And right now, those of using them as an evaluative tool requires some caution. So I think in that case, you default to what the results on the floor are. And from that perspective, like I know I'm always kind of the stock pessimist for us, but I thought voters did a good job. I thought they looked at Missouri and they said, this team has beaten teams that we think are, you know, going to be, you know, quality opposition. They've done it on a road and a neutral floor. We're going to reward them for that. And I think that was justified. I think the question is, was that true to Missouri's character? And I think you and I have always sort of thought maybe water was going to find its level at a certain point. The question is, where is that? And I think that's what we're kind of talking around right now is that a settling out at 6th or 7th? Is it 9th or 10th? You know, that's really, I think, where we are right now. And it's hard to speak definitively on that. But I think as you go through, you know, the early results of SEC play, I think what we're seeing is, you know, one, better health. I think obviously they haven't had any catastrophic injuries or a slew of minor ones that have forced them to scramble and adjust. I'd say we still have qualms at times with Pinson and Tillman, but I think they are slightly more reliable than they were a year ago. And as we've mentioned a lot, the jump shooting is probably not going to improve. It probably is what it is. I think I sent you this today. If you look, like, if the offense's goal is to create corner threes, after 9 games in 2019 and 2020, Missouri was shooting 19% on corner threes after 9 games a season ago. After 9 games this season, what is their percentage? What do you think it is? I know you know, but just humor.
if you'd asked me to guess, I'd have guessed maybe 23 or 4%.
It's 20%. It's literally the dead same. The number of attempts last year at this time from the corner were 52. This year, 55. It's basically a carbon copy of their jump shooting from a year ago. And as I wrote a couple of weeks ago, that trend line stems back a couple of years. So, like, if you're going to evaluate this team today, like, they're in better health, which is good because it means their rotation is stable. They've got, you know, better performance on guys who need to provide that. But if you're hoping that last year was just sort of an anomaly, it's not. So as you assess that moving forward, like, I think that, you know, as we go into facing A&M and as, you know, we move on through that, this, you know, the one thing about a lot of continuity and experience is, you know, you are kind of what you are at this point. And the real question is, what does that generate results-wise for Missouri? And coming into this year, to circle back to your point, we thought that if they had better health and a little more consistency, they might be a team that would get to 9 or 10 SEC wins. And they're kind of on that trajectory right now. So I don't think, and I think as we assess where they sit now, what's happened is the non-conference season maybe inflated some expectations when realistically, like, the team has kind of performed like we thought it would. It front loaded a lot of really quality results. But I think as we move through the season, we're going to see it level out. And to me, I still think that it winds up putting them around eighth or ninth in the standings. But we'll see. We'll see how things fare out. We'll see how, you know, we'll let the outcomes actually come in and evaluate them.
Well, it's certainly been interesting, you know, kind of watching the overall kind of start to SEC play, because I do think that there was, you know, and we've talked about variance a lot, and there's been more variance on a regular basis than even I expected. And Missouri was really resistant to that early on. Like, they were consistent, you know, offensively for the first, you know, five games. They looked like the kind of team that, you know, not, it's like I said, yeah, I think if all things are equal, I think Missouri is a team that should be able to, you know, get to the NCAA tournament. I think 500 is probably about where they'll, or maybe slightly above 500, and in the SEC is about where they're probably going to end up. You know, but the way that things have varied from the start of the season for me is been kind of wild. You know, like I think one of the teams that we were both high on was Alabama, kind of coming into the season, and they looked bad, you know, for a large chunk of the season, to the point, you know, they got embarrassed by Stanford, and Stanford's pretty good, but they got embarrassed by Stanford. You know, they were struggling to beat so-so teams. They struggled against Furman. Lost to Western Kentucky at home, you know, and then, like, they just blew the doors off Ole Miss. They shot really well against Tennessee. They shot really well against Florida. And then they were capable of outscoring Auburn with Sharif Cooper back in the mix. You know, and I do think that that's another thing. You know, Auburn's a team that I sort of gave them a one-spot Sharif Cooper bump, you know, mainly because the team that we saw, like, Auburn was bad, and they're 0-4 in league play, but they were way more competitive with Sharif Cooper because, hey, like, having a good point guard is important for that offense. Who'd have thought that adding one would make them better? They're still going to be leaky on defense, but I just think, like, looking at a team like Alabama, we thought they would be good. And if you look at the entire non-conference season, you're like, oh boy, that's it's kind of a rough start. Maybe they'll be more like they were last year. Maybe they'll be like 500, a little erratic, you know. But they're 4-0 right now.
I looked at, you know, when I go through and I pick the schedule, I do it in kind of like 6-game chunks. You know, aside from a few results, like I look at the standings, and this is kind of, you know, setting aside Mississippi State and Auburn, kind of what I thought the standings were going to look like in a lot of ways. I thought South Carolina was going to play more than one conference game, but I think the one thing, as I, you know, you talk about Arkansas, like I look at a team like Arkansas, their schedule was set up in a way that I thought they would go through the first 6 games at like 2-4 or 3-3. And same with Missouri. I just thought the way those schedules were loaded up was going to make maybe for a bumpier ride on the front end, but both teams kind of get back end or have back ends of their slates where they can really make some hay. And I think that's the other thing to kind of take into account here is how the schedules are structured and is going to feed into that. I thought Alabama would be 3-1 right now. And I had Tennessee at 3-1. I had LSU at 3-1. I did have Arkansas at 2-2. I had Florida at 3-1. But I had Missouri right now at 2-2. I assumed they were going to beat Mississippi State, and you know, but you know that, and then you know, maybe take a loss to LSU. But I had Missouri at 2-2. So as I look at it, I think you sort of made the point after you wrote your piece when you were just texting with me that, you know, the league right now kind of looks semi-familiar in a way. Whether that holds up amid, you know, COVID stoppages and stuff is going to be interesting to see. But it'll be fascinating to me if, like, the only real outliers here are Mississippi State being good and Auburn being bad. Because I could have foreseen Auburn potentially hitting the skids if they ran into issues. Like, if Cooper got hurt, he didn't get hurt, but he was delayed, you know, with eligibility questions. And Mississippi State, you know, there's always one of those teams every year where you're kind of surprised by what player development does. Like, if you had said to me DJ Stewart and Iverson Molinar were going to be just that potent, and it wasn't just what they did against Missouri. I mean, it was a shooting exhibition against Missouri, but they'd been playing really well going into that game. And just, like, Iverson, the way those guys have developed is just awesome. Like, and that's a credit to that staff and to those guys for turning themselves into that kind of perimeter duo. But you can't always foresee that coming. But everything else is sort of like falls within, like you were saying, if you look at the movement of where you had teams projected and where they sit now and where we pegged them, not a lot of it is shocking. I think it only looks different because, you know, non-conference was so stilted and disjointed. We didn't really get a good sense for these teams. You know, it's hard after just 5 or 6 games to really get a good feel for everyone. But as through the first, you know, quarter of the conference schedule, things kind of look vaguely familiar. If you're a Missouri fan, though, you're hoping that Missouri's one of those outliers and is going to get back to the team it was the first 3 or 4 games and makes a push up the standings, because there's room for it if they want to you know, put together a run.
Yeah, and coming back, I mean, anytime you have to go to College Station, you know, it's going to be a tough game. But certainly Texas A&M, they don't seem to quite have the same luck that they very clearly had last year. And I think part of that, like I think one of the things with Texas A&M that, and it's kind of like maybe the same thing with Stewart and Molinar, is I don't quite think you look at you know, that team that had Josh Nebo, who I always really liked, and Wendell Mitchell as a guy who was crafty, and Savion Flagg, who has proven to be at worst consistent, or at least consistently like a solid player, and a coach like Buzz Williams, and you take sort of the core of those guys with some new blood, and suddenly they're a lot better. But you know, them going 10-8 last year in conference was sort of out of bounds for how good of a team they were. They were not a good team. I mean, like, we all like to hammer on, you know, on Jesse Newell, but over the course of a season, like, you have X number of possessions that you get to play, and how you handle all those possessions is it proves over the course of the season how good of a team you are. And Texas A&M was 10-8 in the league, but they were 131st in KenPom. You know, so I think coming into the season, losing Mitchell and losing Nebo, I thought was going to set them back. And certainly it has. I mean, they beat, again, a Sharif Cooperless Auburn team, but it only beat it by a couple points. And they've lost two games in a row, and they've scored 54 points. So, yeah.
Like, you look at a guy like Quentin Jackson, who was solid last year. He's been about the same. You look at, you know, a guy like Andre Gordon, who was not great last year, but at 79.2 for his offensive rating, he's at 92.2 this year. You know, I think, you know, J.J. Chandler has never, you know, has regressed his last 2 years from a pretty good sophomore campaign. Savion Flagg, too, has, you know, is average. And, you know, you look at a guy like Jonathan Aku, who you thought might take a step forward, and that really hasn't happened. It's like we talked about this team's potential of them having, you know, three or four guys who are like 6 to 10 point scorers around Flag, and bringing in Marfo to kind of be your Josh Nebo, and, you know, then having Jonathan Aku, you know, maybe take a step forward as a sophomore, and Jackson Robinson, who was a touted freshman coming in. And you thought if they take some moderate steps forward and improve, no, they could probably go 10-8 again. But that hasn't happened. It just seems like a lot of guys on that roster, you know, outside of like an Emmanuel Miller, who has really improved, only Emmanuel Miller's really taken a positive step forward for them. And, you know, if your veterans like Flagg or Chandler or Quentin Jackson aren't able to produce for you, you're really just looking at a roster that's doing a hard reset right now. And I think that's kind of where Buzz is at this point. Is I think he did such a good job last year getting people to buy into the culture, and they bought into being a defense first team and being tough and playing for each other and doing and finding a way to kind of coalesce around that identity. But like you said, Wendell Mitchell, not flashy, but he was going to get you 12 to 14 a game. Nebo, not flashy, but he was going to defend the rim and rebound. They just haven't had those kind of assets really step forward or emerge yet.
And also, and with Nebo, I think an underrated thing was he was one of the fiercest dunkers. Like, capable of giving the entire team a boost with how, like, hard he would dunk the basketball. And I realize that comes off as something that maybe is a little flippant, but I don't think you can really, having that level of energy and excitement off of a made basket is something that I really do think carries a lot of weight. And I think, like, even like Xavier Pinson's dunk against Auburn last year, and or was that? That was Florida. Yeah, so the dunk where he kind of caught it on the break and kind of caught Omar Payne a little bit. Like, stuff like that really generates a lot of excitement. And I think Nebo, for all of his, I mean, not being a guy you necessarily wanted to throw the ball to on the block, he was an elite pick and roll guy because, I mean, once you got him into the short corner, once you got him on dump offs, on putbacks, you know, for what Texas A&M was trying to do. And I just, like, they're just never going to get that kind of production from Marfo, who's a little bit more grounded as a post guy. Yeah, like, he's a guy, he'll do some cleanup and stuff like that, but but he's not going to generate the level of energy and excitement that Nebo and what was capable of. So,
and it's, I think the hard part for them is, I look at this team last year, and they found a way to be tough and stick in games. They got destroyed by LSU. They eked out a home win over, you know, a Sharif Cooperless Auburn. Went to South Carolina, got destroyed. And then I watched, you know, the first full game I saw them in SEC play was against Tennessee. And Tennessee had that one in control, like, after 6 or 7 minutes. Like, the level of non-competitiveness in some of these games early on, I think, is discouraging. Because they were very, they would compete their asses off last year. And you would look at them in, you know, I'm going to pull it up now, because they were ranked 77th in adjusted defensive efficiency overall, but they were 5th in the SEC. They guarded their asses off. And right now, they're 10th. Like, the slippage defensively is probably what I've noticed, but they're dead last in offensive efficiency, which I didn't expect. I thought they would at least, you know, get to 8th or 9th, be average on the offensive end, and I thought they would find a way to grit their way into some games and then have some veterans, whether that was, like we said, whether that was going to be a Quentin Jackson or it was going to be Savion Flag, you know, carry them home, and that hasn't happened for them. So if you're a Missouri fan, you know, facing an offensively challenged team on the road and one that's struggling to defend right now is probably a good remedy for you. So if you're looking at it from Missouri's perspective, if you're coming off a layoff, there are worse teams to get right now than A&M, because they just look disjointed from the identity that gave them so much lift last season.
Yeah, so part of their issue this year has been on the offensive side. I mean, obviously we've talked about slippage in defense, but the offensive side, and offensive efficiency, they're at 87 points per 100 possessions. Man, that is brutal. But I was looking at the turnover rate, which in conference play is at it's 25%, which is one out of every four possessions.
And when you play the tempo they do, that's just not sustainable. It's just it cuts your legs out from underneath you.
Yeah, so part of that, they're relying on a guy that I like a lot as a, you know, projecting out as a point guard, and that's Hassan Diarra.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a freshman, and this is one of those things where we talk about relying on freshmen for big bulk minutes, and there's a difference between what kind of freshman you get. And Diarra is a guy who's going to be really good, but he's like top 60, I think, top 75, yeah. Which is a guy that you can play a lot early, but not a guy that you need to be relying upon. And I think particularly at a point guard position, which is a really, really tough position, you know, to play as a young player, unless you are elite. I think Diarra will get there, but they just don't really have, even like Andre Gordon is not a guy who I think you're really comfortable with as a point guard. He's a little bit more of a combo guard. So when you have kind of two guys who aren't great handling the ball to start, you know, Diarra's turnover rate is like 34%, and
what's a testament to what you're saying is, like, you break out their live ball turnovers versus their non-live ball turnovers, like, more than half of them are dead ball, are what you would, aren't forced turnovers. Like, they're just bad decision makings, they're poor passes, they're bobbled passes on the receipt end of a play. I mean, 14% of their turnovers are 14% of possessions are ending with a non-steal turnover, which tells you that they're having some issues in terms of initiating offense and running offense. And if you're putting a lot of that on DR to be your creator, it makes sense why that would happen.
Well, if you follow me on Twitter, I think I actually pointed out, like, that's one of the things after they beat, I think they beat Auburn. They beat Auburn in like a last second shot. Right? Wasn't that game? Andre Gordon hit that bank shot, yeah. But they were talking to Buzz Williams, and that was one of the things that he was talking about. And that's one of the things, like, I always appreciate about Buzz, is his ability to sort of, you know, take the media in general, like, a lot of these guys ask really sort of bad questions. And he took kind of a bad question and turned it into just a phenomenal answer. And it ended up kind of being about how he's teaching these guys about their turnovers and how many live ball turnovers they have. And you know, it is like one of those things that when you talk about like the momentum of a basketball game, like live ball turnovers can be killers. And it looks like, you know, Texas A&M is just living through a lot of those bumps right now. Overall, I love that hire. I love what Buzz Williams is, what I think he's going to accomplish. I think within a couple of years, like, that's going to be a top four SEC basketball team, like, on a pretty regular basis. It's just a really, really great hire. And
they're 237th in experience, and he's running a lot of young guys through. They're 65th nationally in bench minutes. So, I mean, they're moving some youth through at certain positions. So it makes sense. They've got a great class coming in next year as well. So
yeah, he's got a top 30 two guard, I think.
Yep. You put him and Diarra together, and Jackson Robinson was a top 50 kid who's playing behind Flag right now, but it's going to be really good. They're going to have a good backcourt next year.
I'm really just, like, if you give Robinson like another 10 or 15 pounds, he could be a monster. But yep. he is a slight 6'7" right now.
Yeah, he's lean, and I think that's the, you and I have talked about this, and we promise we will talk less about Texas A&M. Is, you know, Buzz and Jerry Stackhouse took diametrically opposed approaches to guys like Eric Musselman and Nate Oates, which is they didn't turn their rosters over insanely fast. You know, they're bringing in, you know, they're not, you know, Marfo is a transfer, but he was brought in to, you know, anchor a position to be a one-year stopover because they were going to still be young along the front line. But, you know, Buzz is gradually turning the roster, gradually bringing in his guys, getting vets to buy in and play in his culture. And, you know, I think a lot of people are going to look at the Buzz hire after, you know, 1 or 2 years and go, oh God, this is looking bad. And then year three, you're going to look up and be like, oh God, there's like three top 20 recruiting classes here. And holy crap, they defend their asses off. And oh man, Hassan Diarra has gotten so much better. Man, look at Robinson. He's put on his that weight, and he's improved, and his jumpers come along. And you're going to look up at this team, and you're going to be like, yeah, that looks like a Buzz Williams team. And, you know, even you look at a team like Vandy this year, you know, Vandy hasn't always been great, but they've got a guy in Scottie Pippen. Dylan DeSue's look good at times. And so I think it's a testament to how different the models of rebuild are. And a lot of praise and attention is getting lavished on what Eric Musselman's done and what Nate Oates is doing. I think Buzz is quietly working, and it'll show up pretty soon, or it'll manifest itself pretty soon.
I agree. So that's who Missouri is, I think, most likely to play. If they are able to go off pause and play a basketball game this weekend. In the meantime, I think we just sort of sit and wait and see what's going to happen.
We did that for 8 months, so, I mean, nothing new.
Yeah, it was a little weird, like, on Saturday. You just sort of get into the rhythm of, trying to get into a rhythm of college basketball season. I did watch some college basketball, but not Missouri. So hopefully they're back. Regardless, we'll be back next week, right? I think Beyond the Box Score is going to record. I think Nate Edwards is going to return to the mic, fighting through the newborn, you know, baby blues. I don't, is it baby? Like, it's not really, like, I'm not.
It's just lack of sleep.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, it. I know it sucks. Like, I'm sure he's thrilled with his kid and all that kind of stuff. But, not sleeping sucks. But I think he's going to return to the mic. So I think if you are subscribed to the podcast, You will get a brand new episode of Beyond the Box Score this week featuring Brandon Kiley and Nate Edwards.
Much more upbeat than us, probably. Much more upbeat.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know BK is. He's always like, I think
he's a professional.
Though. Yeah, like I think there was something on Twitter the other day about how someone was giving him a hard time for always sounding like he's smiling when he's talking. And if you,
that's called a professional, like, broadcaster.
Like, what's funny is, like, if you know BK, like, that's just like, that's how he is. And I've had many off-air conversations with Brandon because I consider him a friend at this point, and he's just, he's always like that. It's funny. He is a professional broadcaster even in his personal life. So that's this BK. But Matt and I are done. We're out of here. Make sure you follow Matt where he gives you all the deep thoughts and analysis on the Twitter sphere. You can
like Missouri can't shoot real deep analysis.
Mitch Smith is good at defense.
Don't pass in the ball in the corner.
Yeah. Stop shooting threes, guys. Okay, but yeah, we'll be back. Follow me on Twitter, Sam T. Snelling. Follow Matt J. Harris, 85. All complaints go to Mitch, blah, blah, blah. We'll see you guys next week. We'll be back with more dive cuts. Until then, thanks for tuning in.